Disc 19.
A few months earlier, at one of Hillary's millennium evenings at the White House, Dr. Eric Lander, director of the Whitehead Institute Center for Genome Research at MIT, and high-tech executive Vinton Cerf, who is known as the father of the Internet, discussed how digital chip technology had enabled the Human Genome Project to succeed. The thing I remembered most clearly about the evening was Lander's statement that all human beings are more than 99.9% alike genetically. Ever since he said that, I had thought of all the blood that had been shed, all the energy wasted by people obsessed with keeping us divided over that 0.1%. In the radio address, I again asked the Congress to pass the hate crimes bill and asked the Senate to confirm a distinguished Chinese-American lawyer, Bill Lan Li, as the new Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. The Republican majority had been holding him up. They seemed to have an aversion to many of my non-Caucasian nominees. My main guest that morning was Charlotte Fillmore, a 100-year-old former White House employee who decades earlier had had to enter the White House through a special door because of her race. This time, we brought Charlotte through the front door to the Oval Office. In the week leading up to the State of the Union address, I followed my usual custom of highlighting important initiatives that would be in the speech. This time I was incorporating two proposals Hillary and Al Gore were advocating on the campaign trail. I recommended allowing parents of children eligible for health insurance under the CHIP program to purchase insurance for themselves, a plan Al was promoting, and I supported making the first $10,000 of college tuition tax deductible, an idea that Senator Chuck Schumer was pushing in Congress and Hillary was advocating in her campaign. If all the parents and children who were income eligible, about 14 million, bought into the CHIP program, it would take care of about a third of our uninsured population. If people 55 and over were allowed to buy into Medicare, as I had recommended, the two programs together would cut the number of uninsured Americans in half. If the tuition tax credit was adopted, along with the college aid expansions I had already signed into law, we could rightly claim to have opened the doors of college to all Americans. The college enrollment rate had already risen to 67%, almost 10% higher than when I took office. In a speech to scientists at California Institute of Technology, I unveiled a proposed increase of nearly $3 billion in research, which included $1 billion for AIDS and other biomedical purposes, and $500 million for nanotechnology and major increases for basic science, space, and clean energy. On the 24th, Alexis Herman, Donna Shalala, and I asked Congress to help close the 25% pay gap between men and women by passing the Paycheck Fairness Act, giving us the funds to clear up the large backlog of employment discrimination cases at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and supporting the Labor Department's efforts to increase female employment in high-wage jobs in which women were underrepresented. For example, in most high-tech occupations, men outnumbered women by more than 2-to-1. On the day before the speech, I sat down with Jim Lehrer of PBS's NewsHour for the first time since our interview 2 years earlier, right after the storm over my deposition broke. After we went through the achievements of the administration over the previous 7 years, Lehrer asked me if I was worried about what historians were going to write about me. The New York Times had just published an editorial saying historians were beginning to say I was a politician with great natural talent and some significant accomplishments, who had missed the greatness that once seemed within his grasp. He asked me about my reaction to the what-might-have-been assessment. I said that it seemed to me that the time most like our own was at the turn of the last century, when we were also moving into a new era of economic and social change and were being drawn into the world beyond our shores more than ever before. Based on what had happened then, I thought the tests of my service would be, did we manage the transition of America into the new economy and an era of globalization well or not? Did we make social progress and change the way we approached our problems to fit the times? Were we good stewards of the environment? And what were the forces we stood against? I told him I felt comfortable with the answers to those questions. Moreover, I had read enough history to know that it is constantly being rewritten. While I was in office, two major biographies of Grant had been published that dramatically revised the conventional assessment of his presidency upward. That sort of thing was going on all the time. Besides, as I told Lair, I was more focused on what I could accomplish in my last year than on what the future might think of me. Beyond the domestic agenda, I told Lair that I wanted to prepare our nation to deal with the biggest security challenges of the 21st century. The Congressional Republicans' first priority was building a national missile defense system, but I said the main threat was the likelihood that you'll have terrorists and narco-traffickers and organized criminals cooperating with each other with smaller and smaller and more difficult to detect weapons of mass destruction and powerful traditional weapons. So we've tried to lay in a framework for dealing with cyber terrorism, bioterrorism, chemical terrorism. Now, this is not in the headlines, but I think the enemies of the nation-state in this interconnected world are likely to be the biggest security threat. I was thinking about terrorism a great deal then because of the nail-biting 2 months we'd had leading up to the Millennium Celebration. The CIA, National Security Agency, FBI, and our entire counterterrorism group had worked hard to thwart several planned attacks in the United States and the Middle East. Now two submarines were in the Northern Arabian Sea, ready to fire missiles at any point the CIA determined to be bin Laden's whereabouts. Dick Clark's counterterrorism group and George Tenet were working hard to find him. I felt we were on top of the situation, but still did not have either the offensive or defensive capabilities we needed to combat an enemy adept at finding the opportunities to attack innocent people that an increasingly open world offered. Before the interview was over, Lair asked me the question I knew was coming. If 2 years ago I had answered his question and other questions about my conduct differently right at the beginning, did I think there might have been a different result and that I might not have been impeached? I told him that I didn't know, but that I deeply regretted having misled him and the American people. I still don't have the answer to his question, given the hysterical atmosphere that had engulfed Washington at the time. As I told Lair, I had apologized and tried to make amends for my mistakes. That was all I could do. Then Lair asked if I took satisfaction in knowing that if there was a conspiracy to run me out of office, it hadn't worked. I believe that was as close as any journalist ever came in my presence to admitting the existence of the conspiracy they all knew existed, but could not bring themselves to acknowledge. I told Jim I had learned the hard way that life always humbles you if you give in to anger or take too much satisfaction in having defeated someone, or think that no matter how bad your own sins are, those of your adversaries are worse. I had a year to go. There was no time to be angry or satisfied. My last State of the Union address was a joy to deliver. We had more than 20 million new jobs, the lowest unemployment rate and smallest welfare rolls in 30 years, the lowest crime rate in 25 years, the lowest poverty rate in 20 years, the smallest federal workforce in 40 years, the first back-to-back surpluses in 42 years, 7 years of declining teen pregnancies and a 30% increase in adoptions, and 150,000 young people who had served in AmeriCorps. Within a month, we would have the longest economic expansion in American history, and by the end of the year, we would have three consecutive surpluses for the first time in more than 50 years. I was concerned that America would become complacent in our prosperity, so I asked our people not to take it for granted, but to take that long look ahead to the nation we could build in the 21st century. I offered more than 60 initiatives to meet an ambitious set of goals, every child would start school ready to learn and graduate ready to succeed. Every family would be able to succeed at home and at work, and no child would be raised in poverty. The challenge of the baby boomers' retirement would be met. All Americans would have access to quality, affordable health care. America would be the safest big country on earth and debt-free for the first time since 1835. Prosperity would come to every community. Climate change would be reversed. America would lead the world to shared prosperity and security and to the far frontiers of science and technology. And we would at last become one nation, united in all our diversity. I did my best to reach out to Republicans and Democrats, recommending a mix of both tax cuts and spending programs to move toward the goals. Greater support of faith-based efforts to fight poverty and drug abuse and help teen mothers. A tax break for charitable contributions by low and moderate income citizens who couldn't claim one now because they didn't itemize their deductions. Tax relief from the so-called marriage penalty and another expansion of the EITC. Greater incentives to teach English and civics to new immigrants and passage of the Hate Crimes Bill and the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. I also thank the Speaker for his support of the New Markets Initiative. For the last time, I introduced the people sitting with Hillary who represented what we were trying to accomplish. The father of one of the students killed at Columbine, who wanted Congress to close the gun show loophole. A Hispanic father who proudly paid child support and who would benefit from the tax relief package for working families I had proposed. An Air Force captain who had rescued a downed pilot in Kosovo to illustrate the importance of finishing our work in the Balkans, and my friend Hank Aaron, who had spent his years after baseball working to help poor children and bridge the racial divide. I closed with an appeal for unity, getting a laugh when I reminded Congress that even Republicans and Democrats were genetically 99.9% the same. I said, modern science has confirmed what ancient faiths have always taught. The most important fact of life is our common humanity. The speech was criticized by one congressman who said I sounded like Calvin Coolidge in wanting to make America debt-free, and by some conservatives who said I was spending too much money on education, health care, and the environment. Most citizens seemed to be reassured that I was going to work hard in my last year, interested in the new ideas I was advancing, and supportive of my efforts to keep them focused on the future. The last time America seemed to be sailing on such smooth seas was in the early 60s, with the economy booming, civil rights laws promising a more just future, and Vietnam a distant blip on the screen. Within 6 years, the economy was sagging. There were race riots in the streets. John and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. had been killed, and Vietnam had consumed America, driven President Johnson from office, and ushered in a new era of division in our politics. Good times are to be seized and built upon, not coasted through. After a stop in Quincy, Illinois, to hit the high points of my agenda, I flew to Davos, Switzerland, to address the World Economic Forum, an increasingly important annual gathering of international political and business leaders. I brought five cabinet members with me to discuss the popular uprising against globalization that we had witnessed in the streets of Seattle during the recent WTO meeting. The multinational corporations and their political supporters had largely been content to create a global economy that served their needs, believing that the growth resulting from trade would create wealth and jobs everywhere. Trade in well-governed countries had helped lift many people out of poverty, but too many people in poor countries were left out. Half the world still lived on less than $2 a day. A billion people lived on less than a dollar a day, and more than a billion people went to bed hungry every night. One in four people had no access to clean water. Some 130 million children never went to school at all, and 10 million children died every year of preventable diseases. Even in wealthy countries, the constant churning of the economy was always dislocating some people, and the United States wasn't doing enough to get them back in the workforce at the same or higher pay. Finally, the global financial institutions had not been able to head off or mitigate crises in developing countries in a way that minimized damage to working people, and the WTO was perceived as being too captive to wealthy countries and multinational corporations. In my first 2 years when the Democrats were in the majority, I had gotten more money for training displaced workers and signed the NAFTA side agreements on the environment and labor standards. Afterward, the Republican Congress was less sympathetic to such efforts, especially those designed to reduce poverty and create new jobs in poor nations. Now it seemed to me we had a chance to build a bipartisan consensus on at least three initiatives: the New Markets Program, the Trade Bill for Africa and the Caribbean, and the Millennium Debt Relief Effort. The larger question was whether we could have a global economy without global social and environmental policies and more open governance by the economic decision makers, especially the WTO. I thought the anti-trade, anti-globalization forces were wrong in believing that trade had increased poverty. In fact, trade had lifted more people out of poverty and pulled more nations out of isolation. On the other hand, those who thought all we needed were unregulated flows of more than $1 trillion a day of capital and ever-increasing trade were wrong, too. I said globalization imposed on its beneficiaries the responsibility of sharing its gains and its burdens and empowering more people to participate in it. Essentially, I advocated a third-way approach to globalization: trade plus a concerted effort to give people and nations the tools and conditions to make the most of it. Finally, I argued that giving people hope through economic growth and social justice was essential to our ability to persuade the 21st century world to walk away from the modern horrors of terrorism and weapons of mass destruction and the old conflicts rooted in racial, religious, and tribal hatreds. When the speech was over, I couldn't know if I'd succeeded in getting the 1,000 business leaders there to agree with me, but I felt that they had listened and at least were wrestling with the problems of our global interdependence and their own obligations to create a more unified world. What the movers and shakers of the world needed was a shared vision. When good people with energy act on a shared vision, most of the problems get worked out. Back home, it was time for my last national prayer breakfast. Joe Lieberman, the event's first Jewish speaker, gave a fine talk on the values common to all faiths. I discussed the practical implications of his remarks. If we are admonished not to turn away strangers, to treat others as we would like to be treated, and to love our neighbors as ourselves, who are our neighbors, and what does it mean to love them? If we were virtually the same genetically and our world was so interdependent that I had a cousin in Arkansas who played chess twice a week on the internet with a man from Australia, we obviously had to broaden our horizons in the years ahead. The direction of those years, of course, would be shaped by the outcome of this year's election. Al Gore and George W. Bush had both won handily in Iowa, as expected. Then the campaign moved on to New Hampshire, where voters in both parties' primaries delight in upsetting expectations. Al's campaign had gotten off to a rocky start, but when he moved his campaign headquarters to Nashville and began doing informal town hall meetings in New Hampshire, he really started connecting with voters, got better press coverage, and pulled ahead of Senator Bradley. After the State of the Union, in which I featured some of his important accomplishments, he picked up a few more points in the bounce we always received from the speech. Then Bradley began to attack him harshly. When Al didn't respond, Bradley cut into his lead, but Al held on to win 52-47%. After that, I knew he was home free for the nomination. He was going to carry the South and California big, and I thought he would do well in the large industrial states, too, especially after the AFL-CIO endorsed him. John McCain defeated George W. Bush in New Hampshire 49-31%. It was a state tailor-made for McCain. They liked his independent streak and his support for campaign finance reform. The next big contest was in South Carolina, where McCain would be helped by his military background and the endorsements of two congressmen. But Bush had the backing of both the party establishment and the religious right. On Sunday afternoon, February 6th, Hillary, Chelsea, Dorothy, and I drove from Chappaqua to the State University of New York's campus in nearby Purchase for Hillary's formal announcement of her Senate candidacy. Senator Moynihan introduced her. He said that he had known Eleanor Roosevelt and that she would love you. It was a sincere compliment and a funny one, since Hillary had taken a lot of good-natured ribbing for saying she had had imaginary conversations with Mrs. Roosevelt. Hillary gave a terrific speech, one she had written carefully and practiced hard. It displayed how much she had learned about the concerns of the different regions of the state and how clearly she understood the choices voters were facing. She also had to explain why she was running, show that she understood why New Yorkers might be wary of voting for a candidate, even one they liked, who had never lived in the state until a few months before, and say what she would do as a senator. There was some discussion about whether I should speak. New York was one of my best states. At the time, my job approval was over 70% there, and my personal approval was at 60%. But we decided I shouldn't talk. It was Hillary's day, and the voters wanted to hear from her. For the rest of the month, while politics dominated the news, I was dealing with a wide variety of domestic and foreign policy issues. On the home front, I endorsed a bipartisan bill to provide Medicaid coverage to lower-income women for breast and cervical cancer treatment. Made a deal with Senator Lott to bring five of my judicial nominees to the Senate floor for a vote in return for appointing the person he wanted, a rabid foe of campaign finance reform, to the Federal Election Commission. Argued with the Republicans over the Patient's Bill of Rights. They said they'd pass it as long as no one could bring a lawsuit to enforce it, and I argued that that would make it a bill of suggestions. Dedicated the White House press room to James Brady, President Reagan's courageous press secretary. Announced a record increase in funds for Native American education and health care. Supported a change in food stamp regulations to allow welfare recipients who went to work to own a used car without losing their food aid. Received an award from the League of United Latin American Citizens, LULAC, for my economic and social policies and for my major Hispanic appointments, and hosted the National Governors Association for the last time. In foreign affairs, we dealt with a lot of headaches. On the 7th, Yasser Arafat suspended his peace talks with Israel. He was convinced that Israel was putting Palestinian issues on the back burner in favor of pursuing peace with Syria. There was some truth in it, and at the time the Israeli public was more willing to make peace with the Palestinians, with all the difficulties that entailed, than to give up the Golan Heights and put the Palestinian talks at risk. We spent the rest of the month trying to get things going again. On the 11th, the UK suspended home rule in Northern Ireland, despite the IRA's last-minute assurance of an act of arms decommissioning to General John de Chastellain, the Canadian who was overseeing the process. I had gotten George Mitchell involved again, and we had done our best to help Bertie Ahern and Tony Blair avoid this day. The fundamental problem, according to Jerry Adams, was that the IRA wanted to disarm because their people had voted for it, not because David Trimble and the Unionists had made decommissioning the price of their continued participation in the government. Of course, without decommissioning, the Protestants would lose faith in the process, and eventually Trimble would be replaced, a result Adams and Sinn Féin did not want. Trimble could be dour and pessimistic, but beneath his stern Scots-Irish front was a brave idealist who was also taking risks for peace. At any rate, the sequencing issue had delayed establishment of the government for more than a year. Now we were back to no government. It was frustrating, But I thought the impasse would be resolved because no one wanted to return to the bad old days. On March 5th, I commemorated the 35th anniversary of the Voting Rights March in Selma, Alabama, by walking across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, as the civil rights demonstrators had on that bloody Sunday, risking their lives to gain the right to vote for all Americans. Many of the veterans of the civil rights movement who had marched with or supported Martin Luther King Jr. marched arm in arm again that day, including Coretta Scott King, Jesse Jackson, John Lewis, Andrew Young, Joe Lowery, Julian Bond, Ethel Kennedy, and Harris Wofford. In 1965, the Selma March galvanized the conscience of the nation. 5 months later, President Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law. Before the Voting Rights Act, there were only 300 black elected officials at any level and just 3 African-American congressmen. In 2000, there were nearly 9,000 black elected officials and 39 members of the Congressional Black Caucus. In my remarks, I noted that Martin Luther King Jr. was right when he said that when black Americans win their struggle to become free, those who have held them down will themselves be free for the first time. After Selma, white and black Southerners crossed the bridge to the New South, leaving hatred and isolation behind for new opportunities and prosperity and political influence. Without Selma, Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton would never have become president of the United States. Now, as we cross the bridge into the 21st century with the lowest unemployment and poverty rates and the highest home and business ownership rates among African Americans ever recorded, I ask the audience to remember what was yet to be accomplished. As long as there were wide racial disparities in income, education, health, vulnerability to violence, and perceptions of fairness in the criminal justice system, as long as discrimination and hate crimes persisted, we have another bridge to cross. I loved that day in Selma. Once again, I was swept back across the years to my boyhood longing for and belief in an America without a racial divide. Once again, I returned to the emotional core of my political life in saying farewell to the people who had done so much to nourish it. As long as Americans are willing to hold hands, we can walk with any wind, we can cross any bridge. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. I spent most of the first half of the month campaigning for my gun safety measures, closing the gun show loophole, putting child trigger locks on guns, and requiring gun owners to have a photo ID license showing that they had passed the Brady background check and had taken a gun safety course. America had been rocked by a series of tragic shooting deaths, one of them caused by a very young child firing a gun he had found in his apartment. The accidental death rate for children under 15 in America was 9 times higher than that of the 25 next largest economies combined. Despite the crying need and rising public support for gun control, the NRA so far had kept anything from happening in Congress, though most gun manufacturers, to their credit, were now providing child trigger locks. On the gun show loophole, the NRA said, as it had in opposing the Brady bill, that it didn't object to instant background checks, but it didn't want anyone inconvenienced for the public safety by having to endure a 3-day waiting period. Already 70% of the checks were completed in an hour, 90% in a day. A few took longer. If we didn't have a waiting period, people with bad records could buy their guns at closing time on Friday afternoon. The NRA was also adamantly against licensing gun owners, seeing it as the first step toward depriving them of the right to own weapons. It was a spurious argument. We had required driver's licenses for a long time, and no one had ever suggested banning automobile possession. Still, I knew the NRA could scare a lot of people. I had grown up in the hunting culture in which its influence was greatest and had seen the devastating impact the NRA had had on the 1994 congressional elections. But I had always felt most hunters and sport shooters were good citizens and would listen to a reasonable argument plainly stated. I knew I had to try, because I believed in what I was doing, and because Al Gore had put himself squarely within the NRA's gun sights by endorsing the licensing idea even before I did. On the 12th, Wayne LaPierre, the executive vice president of the NRA, said that I needed a certain level of violence and was willing to accept a certain level of killing to further my political objectives, and his vice president's too. LaPierre's position was that we should prosecute gun crimes more severely and punish adults who recklessly allow children access to guns. The next day in Cleveland, I answered him, saying that I agreed with his proposals on punishment, but that I thought his position that no preventive measures were needed was nonsense. The NRA was even against banning cop killer bullets. It was they who were willing to accept a certain level of violence and killing to keep their membership up and their ideology pure. I said I'd like to see LaPierre look into the eyes of the parents who had lost their children at Columbine or in Springfield, Oregon, or Jonesboro, Arkansas, and say those things. I didn't think I could beat the NRA in the House, but I was having a good time trying. I asked people how they would feel if the NRA's no-prevention, all-punishment strategy were applied to every aspect of our lives, getting rid of seat belts, airbags, and speed limits, and adding 5 years to the sentences of reckless drivers who kill people, and getting rid of airport metal detectors and adding 10 years to the sentence of anyone who blows up a plane. On my previous trip to Cleveland, I had visited an elementary school where AmeriCorps volunteers were tutoring young children in reading. A 6-year-old boy looked up at me and asked, "Are you really the president?" When I said that I was, he replied, "But you're not dead yet." He knew only about George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. I was running out of time, but with a high-class fight like this one on my hands, I knew the boy was right. I wasn't dead yet. On March 17th, I announced a breakthrough agreement between Smith & Wesson, one of the largest gun manufacturers, and federal, state, and local governments. The company agreed to include locking devices with its guns to develop a smart gun that could be fired only by the adult who owned it, to cut off gun dealers who sold a disproportionate number of guns used in crimes, to require its dealers not to sell at gun shows unless background checks were conducted, and to design new guns that did not accept large-capacity magazines. It was a brave thing for the company to do. I knew Smith & Wesson would be subject to withering attacks from the NRA and from its competitors. The presidential nominating process was over by the second week of March, as John McCain and Bill Bradley withdrew after Al Gore and George W. Bush won big victories in the 16 Super Tuesday primaries and caucuses. Bill Bradley had run a serious campaign, and in pressing Al early, he had made him a better candidate, as Al scrapped his endorsement-laden approach for a grassroots effort in which he looked more like a relaxed but aggressive challenger. Bush had righted his campaign after losing in New Hampshire by winning in South Carolina, aided by a telephone campaign into conservative white households, reminding them that Senator McCain had a black baby. McCain had adopted a child from Bangladesh, one of the many reasons I admired him. Before the primaries were over, an ad hoc veterans group supporting Bush accused McCain of betraying his country in the 5.5 years he was a POW in North Vietnam. In New York, the Bush people attacked McCain for opposing breast cancer research. Actually, he had voted against a defense bill with some breast cancer money in it to protest all the pork barrel spending included in the bill. The senator had a sister with breast cancer and had always voted for the appropriations that contained well over 90% of the cancer research funds. Senator McCain didn't hit back hard at the Bush campaign or the right-wing extremists for smearing him until it was too late. The developments on the international front in March were largely positive. Barack and Arafat agreed to restart their talks. On my last St. Patrick's Day as president, Seamus Heaney read his poetry, We all sang Danny Boy, and it was clear that although the government was still down in Northern Ireland, no one was prepared to let the peace process die. I spoke with King Fahd of Saudi Arabia about the possibility of OPEC increasing its production. A year earlier, the price of oil had dropped to $12 a barrel, too low to meet the basic needs of producing countries. Now it was jumping between $31 and $34, too high to avoid adverse effects in the consuming nations. I wanted to see the price stabilize at between $20 and $22 a barrel and hoped OPEC would increase production enough to do that. Otherwise, the United States could have significant economic problems. On the 18th, I left for a week-long trip to India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. I was going to India to lay the foundation for what I had hoped would be a positive, long-term relationship. We had wasted too much time since the end of the Cold War, when India had aligned itself with the Soviet Union, principally as a counterweight to China. Bangladesh was the poorest country in South Asia, but a large one with some innovative economic programs and a friendly attitude toward the United States. Unlike Pakistan and India, Bangladesh was a non-nuclear nation that had ratified the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which was more than could be said for the United States. My stop in Pakistan was the most controversial because of the recent military coup there, but I decided I had to go for several reasons: to encourage an early return to civilian rule and a lessening of tensions over Kashmir, to urge General Musharraf not to execute the deposed Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, who was on trial for his life, and to press Musharraf to cooperate with us on bin Laden and al-Qaeda. The Secret Service was strongly opposed to my going to Pakistan or Bangladesh because the CIA had intelligence that indicated al-Qaeda wanted to attack me on one of those stops, either on the ground or during takeoffs or landings. I felt I had to go because of the adverse consequences to American interest of going only to India, and because I didn't want to give in to a terrorist threat. So we took sensible precautions and proceeded. I believe it was the only request the Secret Service ever made that I refused. Hillary's mother, Dorothy, and Chelsea were going with me to India. We flew there first, where I left them in the good hands of our ambassador, my old friend Dick Celeste, the former Ohio governor, and his wife Jacqueline. Then I took a reduced group on two small planes into Bangladesh, where I met with the Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina. Later, I was forced to make another concession to security. I had been scheduled to visit the village of Joypura with my friend Mohammed Yunus to observe some of Grameen Bank's microcredit projects. The Secret Service had determined that our party would be defenseless on the narrow roads or flying in a helicopter to the village, so we brought the villagers, including some schoolchildren, to the American Embassy in Dhaka, where we set up a classroom and some displays in the inner courtyard. While I was in Bangladesh, 35 Sikhs were murdered in Kashmir by unknown killers, intent on getting publicity tied to my visit. When I got back to Delhi, in my meeting with Prime Minister Vajpayee, I expressed outrage and deep regret that terrorists had used my trip as an excuse to kill. I got on well with Vajpayee and hoped he would have an opportunity to re-engage Pakistan before he left office. We didn't agree on the test ban treaty, but I already knew that, because Strobe Talbot had been working with Foreign Minister Jaswant Singh and others for months on non-proliferation issues. However, Vajpayee did join me in pledging to forego future tests, and we agreed upon a set of positive principles that would govern our bilateral relationship, which had been cool for so long. I also had a good visit with the leader of the opposition Congress Party, Sonia Gandhi. Her husband and mother-in-law, the grandson and daughter of Nehru, were both victims of political assassination. Sonia, an Italian by birth, had bravely remained in public life. On the fourth day of my trip, I had the opportunity to address the Indian Parliament. The Parliament building is a large circular structure in which the several hundred parliamentarians sit tightly bunched at row after row of narrow tables. I spoke of my respect for India's democracy, diversity, and impressive strides in building a modern economy, frankly discussed our differences over nuclear issues and urged them to reach a peaceful solution to the Kashmir problem. Somewhat to my surprise, I got a grand reception. They applauded by slapping the table, demonstrating that the Indians were as eager as I was for our long estrangement to end. Chelsea, Dorothy, and I visited the Gandhi Memorial, where we were given copies of his autobiography and other writings, and we traveled to Agra, where the Taj Mahal, perhaps the world's most beautiful structure, was threatened by severe air pollution. India was working hard to establish a pollution-free zone around the Taj, and Foreign Minister Singh and Madeleine Albright signed an agreement for Indo-U.S. cooperation on energy and the environment, with the United States providing $45 million in U.S. aid funds and $200 million from the Export-Import Bank to develop clean energy in India. The Taj was breathtaking, and I hated to leave. On the 23rd, I visited Naila, a small village near Jaipur. After the village women in their brightly colored saris greeted me by surrounding me and showering me with thousands of flower petals, I met with the elected officials who were working together across caste and gender lines that had traditionally divided Indians and discussed the importance of microcredit loans with the women of the local dairy cooperative. The next day I went to the thriving high-tech city of Hyderabad as the guest of the state's chief minister, Chandra Babu Naidu, an articulate and very modern political leader. We visited the high-tech center, where I was amazed to see the variety of companies that were growing like wildfire, and a hospital where, along with USAID Administrator Brady Anderson, I announced a grant of $5 million to help it deal with AIDS and tuberculosis. At the time, AIDS was just beginning to be recognized in India, and there was still a lot of denial. I hoped our modest grant would help increase public awareness and willingness to act before the AIDS problem in India reached Africa's epidemic proportions. My last stop was in Bombay, where I met with business leaders, then had an interesting conversation with young leaders at a local restaurant. I left India feeling that our nations had begun a solid relationship, but wishing I had another week to absorb the country's beauty and mystery. On the 25th, I flew to Islamabad, the leg of the trip the Secret Service thought was most dangerous. I took as few people as possible, leaving most of our party behind, to fly on the larger plane to our refueling stop in Oman. Sandy Berger joked that he was a little older than I, and since we had been through so much in almost 30 years of friendship, he might as well go along to Pakistan for the ride. Again, we went in on two small planes, one with U.S. Air Force markings, the other, in which I was riding, painted plain white. The Pakistanis had cleared an area a mile wide around the runway to make certain that we couldn't be hit by a shoulder-fired missile. Nevertheless, landing was a bracing experience. Our motorcade traveled an empty highway to the presidential palace for a meeting with General Musharraf and his cabinet, and a televised address to the people of Pakistan. In the speech, I noted our long friendship through the Cold War and asked the Pakistani people to turn away from terror and nuclear weapons toward a dialogue with India on Kashmir, to embrace the Test Ban Treaty, and to invest in education, health, and development rather than arms. I said I had come as a friend of Pakistan and the Muslim world, who had stood against the slaughter of Muslims in Bosnia and Kosovo, spoken to the Palestinian National Council in Gaza, marched with the mourners at the funerals of King Hussein and King Hassan, and celebrated the end of Ramadan at the White House with American Muslims. The point I tried to make is that our world was not divided by religious differences, but between those who chose to live with the pain of the past and those who chose the promise of the future. In my meetings with Musharraf, I saw why he had emerged from the complex, often violent culture of Pakistani politics. He was clearly intelligent, strong, and sophisticated. If he chose to pursue a peaceful, progressive path, I thought he had a fair chance to succeed, but I told him I thought terrorism would eventually destroy Pakistan from within if he didn't move against it. Musharraf said he didn't believe Sharif would be executed, but he was noncommittal on the other issues. I knew he was still trying to solidify his position and was in a tough spot. Sharif subsequently was released into exile in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. When Musharraf began serious cooperation with the United States in the war against terror after September 11, 2001, it remained a risky course for him. In 2003, he survived two assassination attempts within days of each other. On the way home after the stop in Oman to see Sultan Qaboos and get our delegation back on Air Force One, I flew to Geneva to meet with President Assad. Our team had been working to get Barack to make a specific proposal on Syria for me to present. I knew it wouldn't be a final offer and the Syrians would know it too, but I thought that if Israel finally responded with the same flexibility the Syrians had shown at Shepherdstown, we might still be able to make a deal. It was not to be. When I met Assad, he was friendly as I gave him a blue tie with a red line profile of a lion, the English meaning of his name. It was a small meeting. Assad was joined by Foreign Minister Shara and Bouthina Chaban. Madeleine Albright and Dennis Ross accompanied me, with the National Security Council's Rob Malley serving as note-taker. After some pleasant small talk, I asked Dennis to spread out the maps I had studied carefully in preparing for our talks. Compared with his stated position at Shepherdstown, Barack was now willing to accept less land around the lake, though he still wanted a lot. 400 meters, 1,312 feet. Fewer people at the listening station and a quicker withdrawal period. Assad didn't want me even to finish the presentation. He became agitated and, contradicting the Syrian position at Shepherdstown, said he would never cede any of the land, that he wanted to be able to sit on the shore of the lake and put his feet in the water. We tried for 2 hours to get some traction with the Syrians, all to no avail. The Israeli rebuff at Shepherdstown and the leak of the working document in the Israeli press had embarrassed Assad and destroyed his fragile trust. And his health had deteriorated even more than I knew. Barack had made a respectable offer. If it had come at Shepherdstown, an agreement might have emerged. Now Assad's first priority was his son's succession. And he had obviously decided that a new round of negotiations, no matter how it came out, could put that at risk. In less than 4 years, I had seen the prospects of peace between Israel and Syria dashed three times, by terror in Israel and Peres's defeat in 1996, by the Israeli rebuff of Syrian overtures at Shepherdstown, and by Assad's preoccupation with his own mortality. After we parted in Geneva, I never saw Assad again. That same day, Vladimir Putin was elected president of Russia in the first round with 52.5% of the vote. I called to congratulate him and hung up the phone, thinking he was tough enough to hold Russia together and hoping he was wise enough to find an honorable way out of the Chechnya problem and committed enough to democracy to preserve it. He was soon off to a strong start, as the Duma ratified both START II and the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. Now even the Russian Duma was more progressive on arms control than the U.S. Senate. In April, I continued to travel the country pushing my education, gun safety, and technology access issues from the State of the Union address, established another national monument, Grand Sequoia, in California, vetoed the bill to put all America's low-level nuclear waste in Nevada because I didn't think all the legitimate questions had been answered, signed the bill ending the earnings limitations for retirees who were collecting Social Security, visited the people of the Navajo Nation in Shiprock in northern New Mexico to highlight our efforts to use the Internet to bring educational, health, and economic opportunities to remote communities, and dedicated the simple but powerful memorial to the victims of the Oklahoma City bombing, 168 empty chairs and rows on a small knoll, flanked by two large entryways and overlooking a large reflecting pool. April also brought the final act in the long saga of little Elian Gonzalez. Several months earlier, his mother had fled Cuba with him for the United States in a rickety boat. The boat capsized and she drowned after putting Elian in an inner tube to save his life. The boy was taken to Miami and put in the temporary custody of a great uncle who was willing to keep him. His father in Cuba wanted him back. The Cuban-American community made Elian's case a crusade, saying that his mother had died trying to bring her son to freedom, and it would be wrong to send him back to Castro's dictatorship. The governing law seemed clear. The Immigration and Naturalization Service was supposed to determine whether the boy's father was a fit parent. If he was, Elian had to be returned to him. An INS team went to Cuba and discovered that though Elian's parents were divorced, they had maintained a good relationship and had shared child-rearing duties. In fact, Elian had spent about half his time with his father, who lived closer to the boy's school. The INS found that Juan Miguel Gonzalez was a fit parent. Advocates for the American relatives took the case to court in an attempt to question the validity of the process in Cuba, thinking it might have been compromised by the presence of Castro's people at the hearing. Some sought to apply the normal state law standard in child custody cases. What is in the best interest of the child? The Congress got in on the act, with various bills being proposed to keep Elian in the United States. Meanwhile, the Cuban-American community was whipped into a frenzy by permanent demonstrations outside the house of Elian's relatives and regular TV interviews with one of them, a highly emotional young woman. Janet Reno, who had served as prosecuting attorney in Miami and had been a popular figure among Cuban-Americans, enraged them by stating that federal law should control the situation and Elian should be returned to his father. It wasn't easy for Janet. She told me that one of her former secretaries would hardly speak to her. The woman's husband had been jailed for 15 years by Castro, and she had waited all that time for him to be released and reunited with her. Many Cuban Americans and other immigrants believed the boy would be better off staying here. I backed Reno, believing that the fact that Elian's father loved him and had been a good parent should count for more than the poverty or the closed and repressive politics of Cuba. Moreover, the United States had frequently tried to get children returned to our country who had been taken away, usually by parents who had lost child custody cases here. If we kept Elian, our arguments for the return of those children to their American parents would be weakened. Eventually, the case became an election issue. Al Gore publicly disagreed with us, saying that he had problems with the INS process and that even if Elian's father was a fit parent, the boy might still be better off in America. It was a defensible position on the merits and understandable, given the importance of Florida in the election. I had worked for 8 years to strengthen our position in the state and among Cuban Americans. At least in that community, the Elian case had wiped out most of our gains. Hillary saw the case as a child advocate and a parent. She backed our decision to reunite the boy and his father. Early in the month, Juan Miguel Gonzalez came to America hoping to take custody of his son in accordance with a federal court order. A couple of weeks later, after Janet Reno had tried for several days to secure the voluntary surrender of the boy, a group of four leading citizens, the president of the University of Miami, a highly regarded lawyer, and two respected Cuban Americans, suggested that the Miami family hand over custody to the father in a secluded place where they could all be together for a few days to ease the transition. On Good Friday evening, I talked to Reno at midnight, and they were still negotiating, but she was running out of patience. At 2 o'clock Saturday morning, John Podesta called to say the talks were still going on. At 4:45, Podesta called again and said the Miami family was now refusing even to recognize the father's custody rights. 30 minutes later, at 5:15, I got another call from John saying it was over. Reno had authorized a pre-dawn raid on the great uncle's house by federal officials. It lasted 3 minutes, no one was hurt, and Elian was returned to his father. A small boy had become a pawn in the never-ending struggle against Castro. Photographs of an obviously happy Elian with his father were published, and sentiment shifted markedly in favor of the reunification. I was confident we had followed the only course open to us, but I was still concerned that it could cost Al Gore Florida in November. Juan Miguel and Elian Gonzalez remained in the United States a few more weeks until the Supreme Court finally upheld the lower court's custody order. Mr. Gonzalez could have stayed in the United States, but he wanted to take his son home to Cuba. In May, I toured schools in Kentucky, Iowa, Minnesota, and Ohio to push our education package, hosted a state visit for Thabo Mbeki, who had just been elected president of South Africa, and promoted the China Trade Bill, which was necessary for China's admission into the WTO. Presidents Ford and Carter, along with James Baker and Henry Kissinger, came to the White House to promote it. This turned out to be a very difficult legislative fight, an especially tough vote for Democrats who depended on labor support, and I brought groups of a dozen or so members down to the residence for several weeks in an intensive effort to explain the importance of integrating China into the global economy. On May 17th, I gave my last Service Academy speech to the U.S. Coast Guard Academy in New London, Connecticut. In 8 years, I had now spoken to each of the service academies twice. Every class filled me with pride in the quality of young men and women who wanted to serve our country in uniform. I was also proud of the young people who came to our service academies from all over the world. This class included graduates from our Cold War adversaries, Russia and Bulgaria. I spoke to the new officers about the fateful struggle in which they would be engaged between the forces of integration and harmony and those of disintegration and chaos, a struggle in which globalization and information technology had magnified both the creative and destructive potential of humankind. I discussed the attacks that Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda had planned for the millennium, which were thwarted through hard work and domestic and international cooperation. To build on that work, I said I was allocating another $300 million to our anti-terrorism budget. On top of the $9 billion request I had already sent to Congress, it amounted to an increase of more than 40% in 3 years. After discussing other security challenges, I made the best case I could for an activist foreign policy, cooperating with others in a world in which no nation was protected any longer by geography or conventional military strength. In late May, just before I left on a trip to Portugal, Germany, Russia, and Ukraine, I went to Assateague Island, Maryland, to announce a new initiative to protect our coral reefs and other marine treasures. We had already quadrupled funding for national marine sanctuaries. I signed an executive order to create a national protective network for our coasts, reefs, underwater forests, and other important structures. And I said we were going to permanently protect the coral reefs of the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, more than 60% of America's total, stretching over 1,200 miles. It was the biggest conservation step I had taken since preserving 43 million roadless acres in our national forests, and a needed one, since ocean pollution was threatening reefs the world over, including the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. I went to Portugal for the annual meeting between the United States and the European Union. Portuguese Prime Minister Antonio Guterres was serving as President of the European Council. He was a bright, young progressive who was a member of our Third Way group, as was EU President Romano Prodi. We saw eye to eye on most things, and I enjoyed the meeting, as well as my first visit to Portugal. It was beautiful and warm, with friendly people and a fascinating history. On June 2nd, I went with Gerhard Schroeder to the ancient city of Aachen to receive the Charlemagne Prize. In a sunny outdoor ceremony in a public space near the medieval city hall and the old cathedral holding Charlemagne's remains, I thanked Chancellor Schroeder and the German people for giving me an honor shared with Václav Havel and King Juan Carlos, and rarely awarded to an American. I had done everything I could to help Europe become united, democratic, and secure, to expand and strengthen the transatlantic alliance, to reach out to Russia, and to end ethnic cleansing in the Balkans. It was gratifying to be recognized for it. The next day, Gerhard Schroeder hosted another of our Third Way conferences in Berlin. This time, Gerhard, Jean Chrétien, and I were joined by three Latin Americans, Enrique Cardoso of Brazil, President Ricardo Lagos of Chile, and President Fernando de la Rúa of Argentina, as we outlined the kinds of progressive partnerships leaders of developed and developing countries should form. Tony Blair wasn't there because he and Cherie, already the parents of three children, had recently brought a fourth into the world, a boy they named Leo. I flew into Moscow for my first meeting with Vladimir Putin since his election. We agreed to destroy another 34 metric tons each of weapons-grade plutonium, but could not reach an accord on amending the ABM treaty to enable the United States to deploy a national missile defense system. I wasn't too concerned about that. Putin probably wanted to wait to see how the U.S. election turned out. The Republicans had been enamored of missile defense since the Reagan era, and many of them wouldn't hesitate to abrogate the ABM treaty in order to deploy it. Al Gore basically agreed with me. Putin didn't want to have to deal with this twice. At the time, we didn't have a missile defense system reliable enough to deploy. As Hugh Shelton had said, shooting down an incoming missile was like a bullet hitting a bullet. If we ever did develop a workable system, I thought we should offer the technology to other nations and that in doing so, we could probably persuade the Russians to amend the ABM treaty. I wasn't at all sure that even if it worked, erecting a missile defense system was the best way to spend the staggering sums it would cost. We were far more likely to face attacks from terrorists having smaller nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons. Moreover, putting up a missile defense could actually expose the world to a greater danger. For the foreseeable future, the system would knock out only a few missiles even if it worked. If the United States and Russia were to erect such a system, China would probably build more missiles to overcome it in order to maintain its deterrent capability. Then India would follow suit, as would Pakistan. The Europeans were convinced it was a terrible idea. But we didn't have to deal with all those issues until we had a system that worked, and so far, we didn't. Before I left Moscow, Putin hosted a small dinner in the Kremlin with a jazz concert afterward, featuring Russian musicians from teenagers to an octogenarian. The finale began on a dark stage, a haunting series of tunes by my favorite living tenor saxophonist, Igor Butman. John Podesta, who loved jazz as much as I did, agreed with me that we had never heard a finer live performance. I went to Ukraine to announce America's financial support for President Leonid Kuchma's decision to close the final reactor at Chernobyl nuclear power plant by December 15th. It had taken a long time, and I was glad to know that at least the problem would be resolved before I left. My last stop was an outdoor speech to a huge crowd of Ukrainians whom I urged to stay on the course of freedom and economic reform. Kiev was beautiful in the late spring sunshine, and I hoped its people could keep up the high spirits I had observed in the crowd. They still had many hurdles to clear. On June 8th, I flew to Tokyo for the day to pay my respects at the memorial service of my friend Prime Minister Keizo Ibuchi, who had died of a stroke a few days before. The service was held in the indoor section of a soccer stadium, with a few thousand seats on the floor divided by an aisle in the middle, and several hundred more people sitting in balconies above. A stage had been constructed with a large ramp up the front and smaller ones on the side. Behind the stage was a wall covered in flowers 25 or 30 feet high. The flowers were beautifully arranged to show the Japanese rising sun against a pale blue sky. At the very top there was an indented space where, at the beginning of the ceremony, a military aide solemnly placed a box containing Obuchi's ashes. After his colleagues and friends had paid tribute to him, several young Japanese women appeared, holding trays full of white flowers. Beginning with Obuchi's wife and children, members of the imperial family, and leaders of the government, the mourners all walked up the center ramp, bowed in respect before his ashes, and placed our flowers on a waist-high strip of wood that ran the entire length of the flowered wall. After I bowed to my friend and placed my flower, I returned to the U.S. Embassy to see our ambassador, former House Speaker Tom Foley. I turned on the television to see the ceremony still in progress. thousands of Obuchi's fellow citizens were creating a cloud of sacred flowers against the rising sun. It was one of the most moving tributes I had ever witnessed. I stopped briefly at the reception to pay my respects to Mrs. Obuchi and Keizo's children, one of whom was in politics herself. Mrs. Obuchi thanked me for coming and gave me a beautiful enamel letterbox that had belonged to her husband. Obuchi had been a friend to me and to America. Our alliance was important, and he had valued it even as a young man. I wished he had had longer to serve. Several days later, while I was participating in the Carleton College commencement exercises in Minnesota, an aide passed me a note informing me that President Hafez al-Assad had just died in Damascus, only 10 weeks after our last meeting in Geneva. Although we had our disagreements, he had always been straightforward with me, and I had believed him when he said he had made a strategic choice for peace. Circumstances, miscommunication, and psychological barriers had kept it from happening, but at least we now knew what it would take for Israel and Syria to get there once both sides were ready. As spring turned to summer, I hosted our largest state dinner ever, as more than 400 people gathered under a tent on the South Lawn to honor King Mohammed VI of Morocco, one of whose ancestors was the first sovereign to recognize the United States shortly after our original 13 states joined together. The next day, I corrected an old injustice, awarding the Congressional Medal of Honor to 22 Japanese Americans who had volunteered to serve in Europe during World War II after their families were interned in camps. One of them was my friend and ally, Senator Daniel Inouye of Hawaii, who had lost an arm and very nearly his life in the war. A week later, I nominated the first Asian American to the cabinet. Former Congressman Norm Mineta of California agreed to serve for the remainder of my term as Commerce Secretary, replacing Bill Daley, who was leaving to become the chairman of Al Gore's campaign. In the last week of the month, I held a gathering in the East Room of the White House, where almost 200 years earlier Thomas Jefferson had spread out the path-breaking map of the western United States that his aide Meriwether Lewis had made on his courageous expedition from the Mississippi River to the Pacific Ocean in 1803. The crowd of scientists and diplomats had gathered to celebrate a 21st century map. More than 1,000 researchers in the United States, the UK, Germany, France, Japan, and China had decoded the human genome, identifying nearly all of the 3 billion sequences of our genetic code. After battling each other for years, Francis Collins, head of the government-funded International Human Genome Project, and Celera President Craig Venter had agreed to publish their genetic data together later in the year. Craig was an old friend, and I had done my best to bring them together. Tony Blair joined us on a satellite hookup, giving me a chance to joke that his infant son's life expectancy had just gone up by about 25 years. As the month drew to a close, I announced that our budget surplus would exceed $200 billion, with a 10-year projected surplus of over $4 trillion. Once again, I recommended that we lock away the Social Security surplus, about $2.3 trillion, and that we save about $550 billion for Medicare. It was beginning to look as if we could handle the baby boomers' retirement after all. I also did a number of political events to support Democrats in Arizona and California and to help Terry McAuliffe raise the rest of the money we needed to put on our convention in Los Angeles in August. We were working closely with him and the Gore campaign through my political director, Minion Moore. Most polls had Gore trailing Bush, and at my press conference on June 28th, I was asked by an NBC News reporter whether Al was being held accountable for the scandals of the administration. I said there was no evidence that he was being punished for my mistakes, that the only wrongdoing he had been accused of involved campaign fundraising, and he wasn't guilty, and that the other so-called scandals were bogus. The word scandal has been thrown around here like a clanging teapot for 7 years. I also said I knew three things about Al Gore. He had had a more positive impact on our country as vice president than any of his predecessors. He had had the right positions on the issues and would keep the prosperity going, and he understood the future, both its possibilities and its dangers. I believed if all the voters understood that, Al would win. In the first week of July, I announced that our economy had now produced 22 million jobs since I took office and went out to the old soldier's home a few miles north of the White House to protect the old cottage Abraham Lincoln and his family had used for a summer home when the Potomac generated hordes of mosquitoes and there was no air conditioning.
End of Disc 19.